Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nothing Venture with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio, I had with me Andrew Pozasti, a junior investor with Angular Ventures. In today's episode, we talked about owning the models whilst the models own the economics in AI, flipping mile wide and inch deep, and dealing with longer feedback loops as a VC, getting advice as a founder, and my favorite, zombies walking on a plank. Listen to the episode to learn more, and if you haven't already, listen to the primer to learn more about Andrew's background. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Nothing Venture. Today in the studio with me, I'm super excited to have Andrew Pozasti. Andrew is a junior investor at Angular Ventures. If you want to catch up on Andrew's background, listen to the primer that was released earlier this week. Andrew, it's excellent to have you here with me in the studio.
Thank you so much. I'm excited. This is great.
Amazing. Yeah. Let's dive straight in. I'm always a little bit confused around job titles within venture.
Yeah.
Do you want to give us a bit of an explainer as to what the different types of jobs and roles that people in venture do?
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a broad answer because all firms are slightly different. So smaller firms, like the general rule is that smaller firms, people have like broader responsibilities. So if you have two or three people, Angular has three people on the investment side. Whereas if you go to like a juggernaut, like your Baldertons or, you know, someone who are very, very well staffed, they have different kind of responsibilities. So, you know, you might be in the research piece, you might be in terms of sourcing. So as you're an analyst, associate, principal, GP is kind of the spectrum. But a principal at one firm could be very different than a principal at another firm. So you see some title inflation, you see some title deflation in other firms. But broadly, you know, you can think as you go up there from maybe research, sourcing, championing a deal to maybe getting a deal through and then becoming a board observer as you kind of move up to the venture scale. And then eventually you want to be able to own a deal yourself. That's kind of the goal. And you know, some firms you'll do that at principal level. And then if those deals go well, maybe you get promoted. Sometimes people just come in from operating or a different way straight into partner. And it sometimes takes them a few iterations to get to that point. So even if partners can vary. And there's some interesting stuff written about kind of hot hands at firms and basically like, you know, how in vogue is like a partner and stuff like that. But broadly, like, as I said, it's vastly different. I think a good kind of rubric or a good proxy would be how big is the firm and how many people, the less people, this title is less important, I think.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, for someone sitting slightly on the outside, you see a lot of titles like, you know, associate or investor or partner or GP. And like, I think for a lot of people, it's often difficult to kind of try and unpick those. So that was super, super useful. Moving on, and we talked about a little bit about this in the primer episode, right? You were a derivatives trader. You were scaling algorithmic trading systems and models. So you have a background in both finance and writing code, right? And
yeah,
writing complex code in Python and machine learning and so on. So you know, you made the jump into VC because you felt that was something interesting that you had an edge in. But I'd love to understand what you had to learn and or unlearn from kind of the hedge fund to make that jump into VC.
Yeah, it's a good question. As I said in my kind of previous answer, I guess the learning component was I felt that, you know, I had worked on really hard problems in this space and that the world was moving that way into the kind of real-time data, real-time models. So if we apply that same kind of like topology of technology that we would run at the fund, you moved into things like, you know, like autonomous vehicles. Mm. You have all these kind of cars sitting there, the edge computing, you have different, you know, computation and data models that sit outside, they feed them. And so you start to see similar kind of systems companies and being built and in totally different ways, but you see a lot of similarities and you see those issues. So I felt like, as I said, I had a lot to learn. On the unlearning part is you are a mile deep and an inch wide in a hedge fund. You invert that when you go to VC. Mm-hmm. you go from being maybe a domain expert, hopefully, to being the dumbest in the room, probably. And your feedback loops are very, very different. So, you know, there's a lot of testing, a lot of sandboxing, and people think that, you know, the feedback loops are, you know, a second, but actually it takes a long time to build product. But, you know, months we're talking about. Whereas, you know, in VC, are you a good VC? And there's, you know, one sense of picking and kind of getting to decisions. But, you know, you might not work that out for years. And there might be ways that you think you're doing well in feed. So, i.e., you back a company and you really like believed in it. Then in 2 years, someone marks it up and you feel amazing. You feel like, okay, I'm a genius, da 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 da. And then 2 years later, they go, they're out of business.
Yeah.
That happens.
Paper valuations are hard to deal with. Yeah.
Exactly. And so you have these long feedback cycles. And there's an interesting thing in VC where you should be saying no 99.5% of the time, but 0.5 of those percent of the time, maybe you should be saying yes and you're saying no. So there's only a small sample of the ones that you have to be honest with yourself, whether you didn't, you got it wrong, you weren't a prepared mind, you were different. So feedback loops are very, very different. Giving yourself a performance review is very different.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, to your point, being the dumbest person in the room, you know, which I severely doubt you'd often be the dumbest person in the room, but that sort of sense of being curious and being willing to, I guess, learn from, you know, from obviously from domain experts, but also having to then bring to bear all the other experience you have working across other businesses within your portfolio or outside or whatever, to add that value back in and to be able to sort of steer and guide the founder into, you know, into going in the right direction. Because, you know, I often see with founders, you may have, you know, some that try and focus on, you know, three different revenue streams, and how do you stop them doing that? Because everything looks exciting. But equally also being able to identify, well, actually, you know, this product actually makes a huge amount of sense in this market where we've been doing some work, you know, with this other business. Like, how do you think about that sort of advice side of guiding founders based on the more abstracted and wider knowledge that you have, like operating generally as a VC?
Yeah, I think the advantage of being in VC is that you have wider, more shallow data points. Mm-hmm. So not like specifically maybe about your business, but like, so right now, you know, Q4, for example, people were missing their sales pipeline. Mm-hmm. So if someone else is missing it, well, you can pass that along. The benchmarks are changing. And they're changing rapidly, and we can update you in real time so you have a better sense of where to go. Maybe like even if you go back to talking to founders early in their journey, you over time you build up an understanding of failure modes, or you get a perception of maybe blind spots. And, you know, at Angular, you know, and my personal philosophy is we're kind of outspoken and opinionated.
We'll talk about that, yeah, for sure.
So we try to, if it's constructive, there's no point if it's just not that interesting, but if it's constructive, we try and give feedback and we try and push you and we try and understand it. So, you know, this is, you know, I think your big blind spot is product, or there's 20 other companies doing this. How can we get a thesis around why you're going to win? Or what is the most interesting version of this company? I don't think you're maybe being as ambitious as you should be. So like, let's, and then trying to make through, you know, make people think about their plan. So getting back to advice, I mean, advice is a big subject. I could give you a macro point about advice for founders. I think your job as a founder is you're going to get advice from everywhere, from anyone. Your job is to like see what works for you, weight the advice. And the same person might give you good advice and give you bad advice, but you need to weight it. And then you have weapons as a founder to get better advice. One is the board and one are advisor seats. If you have a blind spot or a weakness in the company and you really resonate with someone, maybe it's another founder, maybe it's like the CMO of a company that you like, you can offer them, you know, advisory shares, you know, a small portion. Maybe you offer them, you know, 0.25% of the company over 3 years and you have an SLA, so you say to them, listen, once a month we meet or something like that. So you can cultivate good advice. John Collison has this great saying about board members. He calls them Pokemon. And
catch them while you can.
No, just like they, everyone has different powers.
Yeah, sure.
And so at different stage of the company, you kind of want, you know, different powers and you want different advice. And so all I'll say is that about advice, I try and always give advice to founders with the proviso that I could easily be wrong. Mm. Or if it comes from personal experience or if it doesn't. I try to give that caveat to people. And so, yeah, that's kind of it. But I think that's the job of a founder is you need a proliferation of advice.
So yeah, and synthesizing it, take the right. It's really interesting you said this because we just had Annalisa Dragic on the podcast, and she said something very similar, you know, that founders need to figure out ways of surrounding themselves with the right board members, the right advisors, to reach out, right, to actually cultivate that list. And to not be shy of asking, you know, exited founders or VCs for that matter, like who, you know, I have a blind spot around finance or about, you know, around go to market or whatever, who can I speak to, who would be a good person to kind of bring in to give that advice. So I think that is super useful, but equally to your point, and you have given me a lot of advice, I think over the last sort of several months, but it's knowing as a founder, it's knowing how to take that advice on board without, you know, without necessarily being tied to it, right? And being able to your point, weight that advice, but balance it out against your own knowledge. Because again, anyone advising you is going to have a shallower understanding of what's happening in your business or in, you know, what you're doing with your product today. So you need to be able to take that advice, synthesize it, and then, you know, take the best course of action for your business. But something you said there, I think super interesting, you know, about benchmarking, let's say, as an example, missing pipelines, et cetera. So you and I have talked a lot about the state of the market right now. And, you know, Gil Dibner, so one of the GPs at Angular is very outspoken, I think, on Twitter, but in a really, really positive way, I would say, in that, you know, he holds a mirror up. He doesn't hold punches. He kind of explains how he sees and how he thinks about the market moving. But I'd love for you to give us an overview of where the market is today, certainly at early stage, right? Because there is a difference between early and late stage. We just heard again from Annalisa earlier that at late stage, the biggest problem is there is a holding pattern around, you know, exit. So how do you create an exit via IPO or SPAC? No longer really is a thing, but does anyone have the capital to do trade sales? But at pre-seed, seed, and up to Series A, I think there's a difference. And where do you think equilibrium will kind of end up and what the end state would be? It'd be great to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I'll start with how we got here. Because I think people kind of see, oh, the stock market's down or interest rates, but how does that tie into the venture capital market? So to set the scene, how we got here is that there was a few firms, and Tiger specifically, worked out that you could arb the private market to the public market. And what I mean by that is I could go put $100 million into a late stage business, which within the next 2 years was going to IPO, and I would take a spread between what they were worth then and then. And they had great returns, and they were able to put a lot of money in. Like, it's hard to produce great returns, but also to put a lot of money to work.
And quickly as well. Yeah.
And quickly. Yeah. And that's why the IRRs are amazing. So if you think about this, I back a company at, I'll pick a nice easy number, 10 times earnings, and then they would go out in the public market at 16 times earnings, I would make the spread. So they kept doing this, and they got bigger and bigger and bigger. And what happened in 2020, after we had the COVID dip, the markets bifurcated where technology went crazy, where it went to multiples of 60, 80, 100, right? So now the spread became bigger. Every time the public market moves up, the private market's too cheap. So they raised $10 billion plus fund and was writing checks of hundreds of millions a week. I think the fund was bigger off the top of my head, but yeah, maybe $20 billion. So once the market crashed, multiples depressed, these whatever they had in the books just went down by 80%. And so some of these firms are down $5-10+ billion on paper, but it's real because, you know,
there's no exit.
There's no exit.
Yeah.
And so what's now happened is that the later stage, you know, Series C, Series D, the $100 million plus rounds right now are dead because those big firms are hurt. They're really shy. So I kind of think of the way at the market where it is at the moment. There's a couple, I think of it in three different kind of categories. The first category, I call it zombies on a plank. And what I mean by that is, if you think about you going from pre-seed all the way up to IPO, you're walking down the plank, and if you can, you jump over into IPO. You jump into another boat. If you don't, you go into the fish with the sharks.
You can tell you're from Brizzy.
But so you've got these firms who, or these companies who have raised hundreds of millions of dollars, but their economics, you know, they were just going for growth and their economics aren't there. There's no one in Series C, D land to fund them, and they're not IPO worthy at the moment. Those people are what I call zombies. They are, the plank has come back into them. There's nowhere to go. It's a bigger jump for them now. They're really going to have to work out something. What's disappointing for me, a personal perspective, is a lot of those companies are deeper tech companies. Companies like electronic automatic vehicles, you see, they're going to be biology companies. They're going to be companies in the R&D cycles are quite big, but are far from that. Because we've moved from a world of proxies, this is when we're going to get earlier stage, proxies for future revenue to a revenue-based kind of report card for companies. And I'll illustrate that now. So the second group of companies that I see is a little bit of irony. The hottest Series A companies and the seed companies, the ones that like preemptive Series A's, raised at multiples of, you know, 100, 300 in some cases, times their revenue. So we'll take an easy example where some company, hottest company in their space, great brand value, you know, their proxies are all the growth, the usage. They might have had $3 million in revenue and they raised at $1 billion. They raised $50 million, right? So they only had to give 5% away, a great deal. Now those companies are valued maybe at 20 times earnings, let's say. Maybe they've gone from $3 to $5, $6 million. At the best case, maybe that company can now raise at $200 million. Mm. That founder in the hot Series A company has a few choices. I would say, especially someone coming from the public markets where your assets have a price every day, you're used to getting punched in the face, right? Really are. In VC land, not many people get punched in the face. It's like a slow death or blah, blah, blah. So that founder should now work out what they're really worth, then work out what their gross spend is. And so if that person's only got like 30 million left and they're burning about, let's say 20 million in gross, they've got 6 million, so they're burning like, you know, 14 million a year. Maybe they've got 2 and a bit years left of cash. You know, they're going to have to really think about what's the budget here? How can I, because a growth dollar used to be worth 100 or 300 times what it is. Now it's not. It's worth 20.
20 times.
Right? Yeah. So now I need to grow efficiently. And there's things like burn multiple and magic numbers and things that you can look into if you're thinking about this as a company. But I think the first thing is you should, as a founder, really think in your head and like crystallize that you're now 80% less. And it's maybe not your fault. The world's changed. But they're going to have to pivot really quickly in terms of the way that they structure the company and the way they think about the financials. So the highest flying, most interesting companies, some of them are really going to have to rejig here and to go slower. And really think about, you know, the dollar that they spend, what it gets burnt in, and kind of the way it changes. You might have to, as I said, go slower, which is a weird thing for someone who is high flying, but they're going to have to redo it. If they fly into the wall and they don't improve the burn multiples, they're putting the whole company at risk. You know, it could be real trouble for them. But I think most of them are getting good advice and trying to do it. And it's really hard job. Like, it's easy for me to say in the thing, it's really hard to do. So I see those two. And then the third group is just people who are lucky, who actually were maybe at it like, weren't the hottest companies, right? Maybe they raised less. Maybe they only did like, you know, raised $1 million on $5 million or something like that. They actually have, or you're actually just getting started. You're completely accustomed to the new normal and you know the benchmark and kind of, yes, the multiples could still get compressed over time, but like most probably you're at the near the bottom. So if you are, if you grow efficiently and you grow slow, and then you do it the right way. So maybe not grow slow, but you grow efficiently until you work out right ways to spend. You get more predictability in the business. You understand how to where to put money towards. You're going to be such a healthy, fit business that, you know, no matter what happens, you're going to be in a really good place. So we're in this weird world. I looked at the numbers, and it looks like, you know, Q1, I think we're going to be down 65-70% Q1 year on year.
In terms of
just total funding.
Yeah.
But the bulk of that is what we said. It's the later stage funding. What we are seeing at pre-seed and seed is, yes, I'm seeing valuations come down, especially Israel's pre-seed valuations were very, very high. We're seeing that come down to a bit more manageable levels. You know, people used to raise 5, now they raise 3 over in Europe. Maybe, you know, put that down a bit, maybe 3 to 2. But we're not seeing a slowdown in the number of rounds. So seed is still happening. I wrote a piece, and I don't mean to like plug myself, but I wrote about this is the age of small teams with lean plans. I'm a big believer in five, six people, what they can do working together on just getting product market fit and just working on the product. And we're seeing really good plans from companies. And so it's healthy. Rounds are getting done. As I said, you have just different decisions to make. If you were a high-flying company previously, you just have to rejig and reorient to the new reality.
Yeah, I think there's, that's a really useful kind of explanation of where the market sits. I think we're going to see over the next 6 months or so is obviously down in flat rounds, but possibly like whole recapitalization. So the whole cap table being reworked effectively to deal with the inflation that happened with these higher valuations. But I think exactly that everything I'm hearing and seeing is in the pre-seed seed market. Well, actually, because they're coming in with a low capital base already, or no capital base for that matter, to your point, they're getting what they can get, and they're already cutting their cloth on that basis, right? They're not having to rethink the entire structure of the business, because like I spoke to, you know, founder raised sort of an A round, was going for growth, but the industry that he's in has had the rug pulled out from underneath slightly. So, you know, they were planning on growing from 75 to 100 plus employees. They're now actually scaling back, and, you know, they've now got to figure out how to make that capital still work for growth. Yeah. But, you know, with one eye on how they're going to get to that next round. And I think, to your point, the kind of zombies on a plank is a good analogy. That gap between jumping off the plank and getting into the boat is much wider, right? And so I think what we're going to see over the next sort of 6-12 months at a personal level, and without necessarily having looked at too much data, and I'm already seeing this a little bit, is, you know, companies going to the wall because they just can't get to a place where they've got either product market fit or go to market fit, and they can't raise the capital. And founders, you know, unfortunately, I wrote recently, you know, over dilution is not a reason not to take funding in a down market. Like, from my perspective, you know, what you were able to get last year, the year before, or certainly 21, you know, is not going to be achievable now. So you need to think about, well, okay, yes, my cap table is going to take a hit. Yes, I'm going to get diluted, but that is also solvable, right? Like, ultimately, you can work out, you know, option plans and reverse vesting, you know, with your investors to make sure that you're made whole to an extent over time. So I think, yeah, people are going to have to probably for the next 6-12 months, as we see the sort of tail end of ventures that kind of raise in 2021, didn't go to market in 22, now going back to market in 23 to raise, that's going to all shake out. But I think from 24 onwards, we'll probably get back to like, okay, status quo. So in 2018, you wrote about AI and ML ventures, which you obviously have a high affinity for, that the winners will be distinguished as those who target high value problems and obtain greater predictive power and create virtuous data loops, right? That was 4.5 years ago. A lot has happened, right, in the AI space, you know, not least the large language models and generative AI that we've talked about on the primer. But we've since had foundation models, multimodal machine learning. We've had transformers and embedded ML, not to mention like low-code, no-code solutions. Does your statement still stand? And how would you update it to reflect, you know, today? How does that thesis change? Or has it?
Firstly, I forgot that people read old blog posts. But so I think
my job as a podcast host to figure out what dumb stuff you've said in the past and what I can catch you out of. No, I'm joking. No, but I'm seriously very, very interested in what you think.
I think I feel like I was right about one thing, and I was definitely wrong about another thing. The thing that I think I was right about is we are going to see value accrue to where you get a data moat with the models. And what I mean by that is everyone is looking now towards reinforcement learning. So if you set a model in a certain criteria, maybe it's in CFO land, and you keep iterating with these folks, you have proprietary data and decisions and the way that the human's in the loop, that over time, no matter if someone comes with a really great general model, they're just not going to be able to compete with you in any way. I wrote about one of the companies that is still a hero of mine. It's a lettuce company that came out of Stanford.
A lettuce.
Okay. Yeah. So they sat on the back of tractors and got the best lettuce data set in the world. And they worked out diseases and when to plant and when to get it. And it is a phenomenal company. Blue River, I'm pretty sure is the name off the top of my head. And they got bought by John Deere for about $500 million. But the point there is they were able to create a data moat in a niche and to do it in a way that accrued value. And I think you will see that even in the world of what we're seeing. I think right now people are looking at, look at all the people putting into ChatGPT, that's reinforcement learning. And they're going to get that data. Google has the advantage in the distribution right now to maybe put that into search. I know Bing is doing their kind of thing.
Trying to. Yeah.
But that's what will separate these companies. So if you know, there is that thing in venture when you go, okay, can three really smart Stanford people come and do this? So I think that's still largely true. What I wrote there, and I still believe that. And I think especially verticals, you know, that will happen. Where I was wrong, or what I didn't even kind of think of, is that value would accrue to the model. I thought that models would be commoditized and data commoditized to the point, unless we did what we were just telling you now. I just didn't see it, because all the models were open source. Back then there was SLAM models, GAN models, you know, certain versions of NLP, and it was open source, and I loved it, and you could use it. But I just never thought that they could become this big and powerful and own the economics. So the other day, OpenAI just put out the API for both Whisper and for ChatGPT. And so now, you know, they're providing low latency APIs. So people are going to build on top of these things, and they're going to accrue a lot of value, and there'll be some opt-in and opt-out. Some really interesting kind of things there. So people owning the model and having just so good, because the data, what I didn't get, what was the piece that I missed? The piece I missed is that these models would be so large and trained on so much data.
Yeah.
We're talking about training on the internet. I mean, that's just a level that I hadn't contemplated. So yeah, I feel like I was right about some things, and I was definitely wrong about the models.
I mean, I think what's really interesting there, you know, you talked about owning the models and the models owning the economics. Yeah. To your point, right? So every man and their dog is currently building on these models, right? And and a lot of it is frivolous, and you know, it's just exploratory and interesting. But yeah. I can only imagine, right, how much data that is actually providing to OpenAI.
Yeah.
To now build whatever comes next, right? I mean, like, they've just released, I think Microsoft just released ChatGPT plus Excel. Mm-hmm. Like, that to me, like, frankly, puts out of play all the FP&A tools that have been built over the last 5 years. You know, I won't name them because, sorry, guys. But, you know, thankfully, I pivoted away pivoted away from that myself. But, like, if you think about the data that will go back into ChatGPT, that will train it and just make it more and more and more efficient and intelligent.
Yeah.
That is kind of, I mean, scary, but not in a necessarily negative way. But it actually beggars belief, like, where that could go over the next sort of 12, 24 months as more and more data piles into that. And to your point, right, if you can create create data moats where you have that data, you are, you know, the owner of that data, and you understand, you know, the value of that, then you can, yes, you can, you know, you can still create value out of that. But if you can own the model, you know, there's businesses that I'm aware of that are building models in the bio space, you know, where actually, to your point, there is immense value just in the tech, let alone, you know, the therapeutics or whatever that might come out of the back end, right? Because the models are now so powerful, and you have stacked models, and you have, to your point, reinforcement learning, where those models are going to start training themselves to become more and more and more valuable, right?
Big time. I mean, it's, as I said, right now I'll reframe it maybe a little bit, is from a venture point of view, we're trying to understand the opportunity for startups.
Yeah.
Right. A lot of the opportunity right now is for incumbents just because they have distribution. Intercom, amazingly, in 6 weeks have already turned out 5 or 6 features on how to summarize all your customer service requests, how to retype it in company voice, and they've just launched it. And I think, I don't know if they changed their pricing, but every Intercom customer globally just got an upgrade immediately to their product.
Yeah.
And if you thought you were going to build a customer service thing on GPT, you just got killed. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be a lot of that. And so what we're trying to think about is the delta between, you know, you can either think at the shovels infrastructure level, or if you think at the application level, which we're talking about, at the application level, we're trying to think about how do you either build a full stack machine learning company like Runway, which is like, we're actually building our own models, our own products that are going to blow away the likes of Adobe and video and stuff like that. Mm. So ground up full stack, or where the delta is like a feature or an interesting wedge into a company, but that's not the crux of the company.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's early days, but right now, as I said, I'm really excited by the activation energy here. There's so many great examples and companies, but still with like skeptical at the startup level.
Yeah, because I think at the startup level, there's a lot of ambition, but maybe it isn't focused in the right direction. Like, I've seen people trying to put out, you know, co-founder GPT, right? Or stuff like that, mm-hmm. which, yeah, seems cool, but like, equally, is there really a market for that? Is that something that is going to have, you know, long-term value? And I guess the other point is, you know, to your point, at the application level, where you have incumbents in a space that already own that space, obviously they're already looking at how they can implement, right?
Like, 100%.
So your example of Intercom obviously is really poignant. And therefore, anyone coming, you know, new into the space is going to really struggle to work against those incumbents. And I think there's always this thing, I always think about this in venture, right? Like, often it's the picks and shovel businesses, which are like non-sexy, you know, not interesting, you know, to tweet about, or, you know, to have LinkedIn posts about, or like TikToks made about, but they're actually the businesses that create like immense value, you know, in the ecosystem. So I think that's really, really valuable. Just kind of as we wrap up, so obviously the podcast is called Nothing Ventured. Mm-hmm. And it's very much driven by my kind of thought process that, you know, everyone should back themselves to some extent and take a leap of faith at some point in their life. I think, you know, it's the best way to learn. It's the best way to grow. But, you know, for those that are kind of coming into, you know, the ecosystem today, you know, as founders, where they may be like, you know, looking at all the tweets and the news and saying, geez, this feels like a really bad time to be, you know, to be kicking off. What advice would you have for them? What should they be thinking about? And what should they be doing?
I think just go back to the fundamentals of what we're trying to do. Don't listen to the VCs like me. Don't look at the blog posts.
That's not very valuable for the podcast, though.
No, as in like, you know, in terms of building a company, like, find something that you're passionate about. You only get, you know, a few cracks at this. And if you want to spend, you know, you don't have to know this at the start that you want to spend 7 years doing it, but go and build product and put it into people's hands and get people's feedback. And, you know, some of the best, most innovative companies started as toys. Something's pivoted. You know, everyone knows the Slack story was a gaming company that had a messaging and then went to the messaging. My point is just try and get better at building and build things and put it into people's hands and get that feedback. And then just, it's quite magical when you get feedback from people, even if it's just in the metrics. You know, you get to see someone using your thing. Oh, they spent like 3 hours today in my silly little toy. And that's the kind of philosophy there, I think. If, you know, instead of trying to like judge where everything's going, and there's these amazing tools, whether you want to use the ones we've been talking about or not, just go and build something and see if it's there. And then if you get that pull, if you get that inkling and you can start iterating, like, that's the time to go for it. I think, you know, I think about speaking to some French people, and it reminds me a little bit of Australia as well, back in a few years ago, but where, it was, you know, passé to be a founder. You know, you go to banking, go to law, go to doctors. But we're now at a maturity level where, listen, go, if you go give it a go and it doesn't work, you know, it's the SF mentality, but it's global, is people will really, like, understand that you've given it a crack and appreciate the work you've done. I know founders in our portfolio love hiring ex-founders because they've got scars, they've built things, they've had to have skin in the game. And so, yeah, that's what I would say. I think just go back to the core fundamentals and hopefully find something that you love the problem.
Yeah.
And build.
Yeah. If I rephrase that as an ex-Aussie myself, have a fair go, right? Like,
yeah, absolutely.
Go out there, take that first step, have a crack, get going. Andrew, it's been absolutely awesome having you here with me today. I really appreciate your time. For our listeners, where can they find you online? You on Twitter, LinkedIn? Where's the best place for them to look for you?
If you want to follow me on Twitter, and I can't promise any high quality value, I have a slightly embarrassing but okay name, @potential, with an E. I did it many years ago, so you'll have to forgive me. But that's probably the best place. Add me to LinkedIn. I also have an open door kind of policy of people, you know, contact me if they're building something. Always happy. It's a long game and a small industry, and I'm always happy to help. So if you want to reach out, I'm always happy to have a chat.
And I can definitely tell you that Andrew is very, very good at coming back to you. I've had many, many conversations with him over the last 6-7 months as well. So anyway, thank you so much, Andrew. It's been great having you here today.
Thank you. I've loved it. Thank you.